They envied the older generation its adventures and leaped at this chance to experience the camaraderie of the campfire and the possibility of becoming a hero. They were also well aware that the government had rewarded the Revolutionary War veterans with land warrants in the West. The volunteers, 13,000 of them, marched into Pennsylvania in two columns. The New Jersey and Pennsylvania troops gathered at Carlisle, the Virginians and Marylanders bivouacked at Cumberland. Washington, magnificently mounted and in his full dress uniform, reviewed the troops in each camp and marched with them as far as Bedford. The roll of the drums, the cadence of the march, the glittering new uniforms, the eager young patriots, the thrilling sight of General President Washington at the head of the column was the way artists of the campaign saw it. The reality was different. As Washington bade farewell and Godspeed, the invasion of western Pennsylvania began. Crossing the mountains through rain and mud proved far more difficult than anyone had imagined. Disease, lack of discipline, insufficient rations, and squabbles about rank and command threatened to dissolve the force. Negotiations over rank, command, uniforms, color, design, and accoutrements occupied far too much of the young officer's time and energy. Where egos and sartorial tastes went unsatisfied, anger welled up. In historian Thomas Slaughter's words, "Honor and ambition often supplanted patriotism as the highest priorities of both the resplendent dragoons riding west and those who petulantly stayed behind." Discipline and desertion were major problems, brought on by the vast gap between officers and privates, of which the most important was that officers could resign their commissions and take a walk, whereas the men were in for the duration. The officers got more and better rations and usually managed to billet themselves in log homes. The men spent the nights in tents or on the open ground. Drunkenness was widespread in the whiskey country, as well as rampant gambling. Both punished among the men, ignored among the officers. Each morning, senior officers sent out patrols to round up deserters, then had those who were caught brutally punished with 100 lashes well laid on. The men were inadequately clothed and fed. 1 month into the campaign, many were barefoot. On October 7th, Hamilton lamented that, "The troops are everywhere ahead of their supplies. Not a shoe, blanket, or ounce of ammunition is yet arrived." Food shortages led to plundering, which harmed relations with civilians along the Army's path and was met with severe punishment. One of Lewis's fellow Virginia volunteers was caught taking a beehive. It cost him 100 lashes. Nevertheless, the desperate men tore down fences for firewood, stole chickens, and, when they could find them, cattle and sheep. Slaughter records, "The journals of officers often read like tourist guides to taverns and scenery along the route, while enlisted men's diaries recounted weeks of hunger and cold." Meriwether Lewis was an exception. Although only a private, he was a planter, a member of the gentry, welcomed into the company of the junior officers of the Virginia militia, who knew that his rank reflected his age, not his station in life. His letters to his mother read like those tourist guides Slaughter described. On October 4th, 1794, from the initial camp in Winchester, Virginia, Lewis wrote his mother. He had only recently arrived, whereas two regiments had been for 10 days, "at this school, if I may term it so, where they have been well equipped, tutored, and now cut a most martial figure." Lewis's company, he reported, "shall this day draw all our accoutrements and receive our first lesson." His first experience in camp was all he had hoped for and more. "We have mountains of beef and oceans of whiskey," he told his mother, "and I feel myself able to share it with the heartiest fellow in camp. I had last night the pleasure of supping with all my acquaintances in Captain Randolph's company. They are all well except himself." His spirits were soaring. He signed off, "Remember me to all the girls and tell them that they must give me joy today, as I am to be married to the heaviest musket in the magazine tomorrow." A week later, on the march to Cumberland, he wrote, "I have retired from the hurry and confusion of a camp with my constant companion, Ensign Walker, to write I know not what. I am still blessed with a sufficiency of bodily strength and activity to support the glorious cause of liberty and my country. The lads from our neighborhood are all hearty. Remind Reuben of the charge entrusted to him. Ever believe me with sincerity, your dutiful son. As the columns crossed the mountains and began to converge on Pittsburgh, the leaders of the rebellion fled down the Ohio River, headed for Spanish Louisiana. Two rebels were captured, marched east for trial, and found guilty of treason, but they were subsequently pardoned by President Washington. The show of force had worked. Although the whiskey tax never was collected, land taxes, poll taxes, and tariffs on imported products were collected. Thanks to these, the victory at Fallen Timbers, and Jay's treaty, the threat of a Western secession receded. It did not, however, disappear. In late October or early November, Lewis received a commission as an ensign in the Virginia militia. When that militia marched home, he volunteered to stay on with a small occupying force charged with patrolling and policing western Pennsylvania under the command of General Daniel Morgan. The enlistment was for 6 months. "I am situated on the Monongahela," he told his mother, "about 15 miles above Pittsburgh, where we shall be forted in this winter. I am in perfect health. I am quite delighted with a soldier's life." He was also feeling the responsibility of being older brother and head of the family. "I would wish Reuben to amuse himself with useful books. If he will pay attention, he may be adequate to the task of running Locust Hill the ensuing year." There was to be more to his decision to stay in the Army than his delight at the soldier's life. He informed his mother that, come spring and the end of his enlistment, he would direct my course down to Kentucky, where he intended to speculate in lands. He also planned to pay the taxes on warrant land his mother had inherited from Captain Marks, part of Marks's bonus for his service in the Revolutionary War, so as to prevent its forfeiture to the state as vacant or abandoned land. 2 weeks later, he wrote to ask his mother to send money to pay the taxes on the warrant land and papers proving ownership. He concluded, "I am in perfect health and constantly employed in building huts to secure us from the clemency of the approaching season. Remember me to all the girls of the neighborhood. Your affectionate son." On Christmas Eve 1794, he made his first complaint as an Army officer. "I am a more confined overseer here than when at Locust Hill," he wrote, "having been ever since my last letter constantly confined to the hunting department. There is no probability of a cessation of axes until the middle of next month." He was learning one of the chief responsibilities of being an officer, concern for his men. "The situation of the soldiery is truly deplorable, exposed to the inclemency of the winter, which is about this time completely set in, without any shelter more than what 8 men can derive from a small tent. Many are sick, but fortunately few have died as yet." For himself, the best he could do for his Christmas feast was a little stewed beef. "But to my great comfort, I have this day been so fortunate as for the price of $1 to procure a quart of rum for a Christmas dram." Sometime that winter, Reuben wrote Meriwether to inform him that their mother was uneasy about his long absence. On April 6, 1795, Meriwether wrote his mother to "press you by all the ties of parental affection not to give yourself any uneasiness about me, as I can assure you I shall not undertake any enterprise more dangerous than being at Locust Hill." He admitted that, "I have had a pretty severe touch of the disorder which has been so prevalent among the troops, almost certainly diarrhea, but have fortunately been restored to my usual state of health." He was due to be discharged in mid-May, at which time he would go to Kentucky to see to your land and to take advantage of a great opening for acquiring lands. Again, he had advice and orders for Reuben. "Encourage Reuben to be industrious and be attentive to business. Remember me to Aunt and Uncle Thompson and all the girls, and tell them that I shall bring an insurgent girl to see them next fall bearing the title of Mrs. Lewis." That last cryptic line had no follow-up to it, but it may have caused Mrs. Marks considerable concern, or perhaps raised her hopes that her boy would soon settle down. If so, she was about to be disappointed. Instead of taking his discharge in mid-May and going to Kentucky, then home, on May 1, 1795, Lewis joined the regular army with the rank of ensign. That same month, he was vaccinated for smallpox. He received a letter from Reuben, who again told him their mother wished his return to Locust Hill. He replied on May 22nd in some wonderfully convoluted sentences. "So violently opposed is my governing passion for rambling to the wishes of all my friends that I am led intentionally to err and then have vanity enough to hope for forgiveness. I do not know how to account for this quixotic disposition of mine in any other manner or its being afflicted by any other cause than that of having inherited it from the Merriweather family, and it therefore more immediately calls on your charity to forgive those errors into which it may at any time lead me, though all I shall ask at present is that you will not finally condemn me until next fall, at which time it will be my task personally to plead an excuse for my conduct." In other words, it was all her fault. He signed off, "Your ever sincere, though wandering son." Seldom would he spend more than a winter at one place for the rest of his life. With the end of the Whiskey Rebellion, the ratification of Jay's Treaty and resulting better relations with the British, and the victory at Fallen Timbers, the army of 5,424 officers and men of 1794 was cut back to 3,359. Thus, Lewis received his commission in the regular army at a time when that army was undergoing a sharp reduction, strong evidence that he had made a good impression on his seniors. Of course, they would have known his stepfather, and probably his father, and his lineage generally, which didn't hurt. The army he entered had many officers who were tied by blood or marriage to distinguished families. More than a third were sons of officers in the Continental Army or in the militia during the Revolution. The army's role was primarily to serve as a frontier constabulary, which caused it to be dispersed into small, isolated garrisons, most with fewer than 100 officers and men. Historian William Skelton, in his authoritative An American Profession of Arms, The Army Officer Corps, 1784-1861, calls these tiny garrisons west of the Appalachian Mountains an archipelago of tiny islets strung along thousands of miles of remote frontier. Discipline was imposed with shocking severity on the enlisted men. Flogging was commonplace, branding somewhat less so, but still used as a disciplinary measure. A court-martial at Fort Defiance in northwestern Ohio found two soldiers guilty of laying their muskets aside and sitting down while on guard duty. They were sentenced to 100 lashes well laid on. Theft of a blanket brought 50 lashes. Striking a non-commissioned officer was a 100-lash offense. Desertion was a major problem, both because so many men gave in to the temptation to run off and lose themselves on the frontier, where they could establish squatters' rights and escape the harsh punishments common to 18th-century soldiers, and because the loss of just two or three men in the small garrisons would badly reduce fighting efficiency in the event of an Indian attack. So desertion was severely punished. When a private ran off from Fort Defiance in the fall of 1795, the officers offered two Shawnee Indians a reward of $10 for bringing him back alive and $20 for his scalp. One of the warriors returned the following day with the soldier's scalp and collected the reward along with many compliments from the officers. On paper, the officer corps was also tightly disciplined. It was governed by Baron von Steuben's Regulations for the Order and Discipline of the Troops of the United States, usually called the Baron and the Rules and Articles of War. Among other things, officers were forbidden to use profanity, express disrespect for their commanding officer or federal or state officials, be drunk on duty or absent without leave, or in any way participate in duels. They were subject to dismissal if convicted of behaving in a scandalous and infamous manner, such as is unbecoming an officer and a gentleman. They were further forbidden to keep mistresses, a habit repugnant to the rules of society, burdensome to the service, ever pregnant with discord, always disgraceful and frequently destructive to men of merit. Most officers cultivated a flamboyant style of life, featuring heavy drinking and wenching. They were allowed at least one soldier from the line as a personal servant or a slave maintained at the expense of the army. Second lieutenants were paid $402 in annual salary, with additional compensation for special assignments, but they had to purchase their uniforms, which were terrifically expensive on the frontier. Skelton comments, lower-ranking officers had only a precarious grip on middle-class respectability. Many officers supplemented their pay by speculating in land, taking advantage of their location in the West. They speculated primarily in the bounty land warrants issued to Revolutionary veterans. Skelton found that one of the dominant characteristics of the officer corps was internal dissension. Indeed, seldom has an army been led by a more refractory and contentious group of men. That officer was a rarity whose career was not punctuated by acts of indiscipline and acrimonious controversies with his comrades in arms, many of which led to court-martial or duels. One cause was the isolation and boredom of frontier posts. This was exacerbated because the officer corps was one of the few places in the early republic in which Americans from a variety of regional, religious, ethnic, educational, and social backgrounds mingled in close quarters. Probably more important was the overblown sense of honor of the officers, especially those from the South. Any officer who issued or accepted a challenge to a duel, or served as a second, or even upbraided a fellow officer for refusing a challenge was subject to immediate dismissal. In practice, neither the War Department nor senior officers made the slightest effort to enforce these regulations. General Anthony Wayne, in fact, urged his officers to duel, telling them to find some other mode of settling their private disputes than by troubling the army with courts martial. There was a logic at work. Duels avoided the expense and inconvenience of frequent courts martial, and in contrast to duels, courts martial tended to perpetuate rather than resolve the frequent personal disputes. In the Army of 1795, one officer declared, "To be publicly insulted, denounced as not a gentleman in the presence of other officers, and not to seek redress in a duel would subject the insulted party to the scoff and ridicule, and what is worse, the contempt of his brothers in arms." Ensign Meriwether Lewis's first posting as an officer of the regular army was to the 2nd Sub-Legion under General Wayne. Thus, Lewis was present at Wayne's headquarters on August 3, 1795, when the 100 chiefs of the tribes of the Ohio region gave their assent to the Treaty of Greenville. In November, a fever swept through the camp. At one point, some 300 of the 375 men at Greenville were sick. Lewis was one of the fortunate. He assured his mother, "I enjoy perfect health." Although there were as yet no formal political parties in the United States, most officers in the 2nd Sub-Legion, like the officer corps as a whole, were Federalists. One of the most contentious political issues of the day was attitudes toward the French Revolution. Federalists, led by Alexander Hamilton, despised it. Jeffersonians, soon to be known as Republicans, embraced it. Embraced it so thoroughly, in fact, that many of them copied the French and used the simple title citizen in addressing one another. Lewis was one of these. He addressed his May 22, 1795 letter to his mother, "Citizen Lucy Marks, Albemarle, Virginia." Lewis's views and his drinking soon got him into trouble. On November 6, 1795, he was brought before a general courts martial at Wayne's headquarters. Charges were brought against him by a Lieutenant Elliot. The first charge, "A direct, open, and contemptuous violation of the 1st and 2nd Articles of the 7th Section of the Rules and Articles of War." Article 1 read, "No officer or soldier shall use any reproachful or provoking speeches or gestures to another." Article 2 forbade challenging to a duel. The specification in the proceeding charged Lewis with abruptly and in an ungentlemanlike manner, when intoxicated, entering his, Lieutenant Elliot's, house on the 24th of September last, and without provocation insulting him and disturbing the peace and harmony of a company of officers whom he had invited there. They had argued politics. Lewis had apparently been thrown out. He then presumed on the same day to send Lieutenant Elliot a challenge to fight a duel. When the charges were read to Lewis, he entered a plea of not guilty. Testimony was taken over a period of nearly a week. The officers of the court then rendered their judgment. "We are of the opinion that Ensign Meriwether Lewis is not guilty of the charges exhibited against him, and sentence that he may be acquitted with honor." General Wayne, the court-martial report concluded, confirms the foregoing sentence and fondly hopes, as this is the first, that it also may be the last instance in this command of convening a court for a trial of this nature. Ensign Meriwether Lewis is liberated from his arrest. Quite obviously, Ensign Lewis could not continue to serve in the same outfit as Lieutenant Elliot. General Wayne transferred the 21-year-old Lewis to the chosen rifle company of elite rifleman sharpshooters. The captain of that company had Albemarle ties. His family came from Charlottesville, although he had been born in Caroline County, Virginia, 4 years earlier than Lewis. His name was William Clark. His older brother was General George Rogers Clark, the conqueror of the Old Northwest during the Revolution and a close friend of Jefferson. In the fall of 1795, William Clark had been in the Army 4 years and taken part in the Battle of Fallen Timbers. In 6 months, he would resign his commission because of ill health and the press of family business, but during that half year, he and Lewis became great friends and admirers one of the other. So the partnership of Lewis and Clark, destined to become the most famous in American history, began because General Wayne preferred to have his officers fight out their differences in a duel rather than in a court-martial, and therefore found for the man who had issued the challenge rather than the one who had followed the law and brought charges. 2 weeks after his release from arrest, Lewis wrote his mother. He said his promised trip home for a visit had proved impracticable. He issued instructions for his stepbrother. "I desire that Jack may be sent to Mr. Maury as soon as he shall have learnt to read tolerably well, being determined that he shall receive a liberal education if at my own expense." Certainly a generous gesture.